Thank you for that very kind introduction. Actually, the subtitle of that could be From the White House to the Hood. That's been essentially the transition that I've made over the last few years. I've been on a search, really, for people who are renewing America's economy and the charity in innovative ways. I've looked at more than 1,000 charitable organizations that are working in the inner cities, and I have been on a mission to find out what works. I've sat down to talk to welfare mothers in Harlem and to talk to recovering crack addicts in Washington, D.C., homeless alcoholic men in Denver. I spent time with heroin addicts in San Antonio, former gang members. I've talked to immigrants from Haiti and Vietnam who are learning entrepreneurial skills in Brooklyn. I've talked to at-risk kids here in Michigan and adults who are also mentoring them. I've been in prisons, and I've talked to felons there who are leaving with a changed heart. I joined forces with African-American pastors in cities like Houston and Pittsburgh, and they are people who are renewing entire communities by addressing both material and spiritual needs. And I've conferred with foundation executives and businessmen who are setting up venture capital funds to support the people that I call social entrepreneurs. Social entrepreneurs are people who approach social problems with the mindset of a businessman, of an entrepreneur in business. They are innovative, results-driven, willing to take risks, nimble in responding to changes, and they can demonstrate a successful track record. These are the people who are renewing civil society from the grassroots up, and they're doing it by empowering people to leave dependency, by inculcating life skills, job skills, and also character. They're helping people by giving a hand up, not a hand out. This is where the virtues of the economy and charity converge. While the term social entrepreneur is a new one, the concept behind it is not. In fact, as I've delved deeper into this field, I've discovered that the principles that make social entrepreneurs effective today in America have venerable roots dating back to the founding of our country. To paraphrase a famous title known to Philadelphia Society members, I'd like to title this portion of my remarks as The Roots of American Compassion. Russell Kirk insightfully documented the founding of America in Philadelphia as a chapter in a story written in Western Civilization based on the cumulative wisdom of Athens, Rome, Jerusalem, and London. The result of this flowering was then planted in American soil, and onto its trunk a new offshoot was grafted. The original tree was that of transcendent moral law, covenant, civic virtue, rights and duties, property rights, and common law. Onto this was then grafted the shoot of the market economy. I would argue that the market economy flourished in America particularly so well because of the other aspects of the rich legacy, which had already prepared the mind and the spirit of America to bear fruit. John Winthrop delivered his famous City on a Hill sermon on the deck of the ship Arbella, halfway between England and Cape Cod in 1630, to remind the pilgrims of the covenant that they had made with the God of Israel and with each other. And I quote, "We must delight in each other, make each other's conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together," he said, "always having before our eyes our commission and community as members of the same body. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill, and the eyes of all people are upon us." End of quote. The settlers had an understanding of theology in which they had been given property and the ability to work as gifts of God, and these were to be released through work. See, for the settlers, producing prosperity and utilizing these gifts was an expression of the fullness of a godly life. Living by the sweat of your brow was seen as virtuous, as was giving a portion of the fruits of one's labor to help others in need. The ability to produce and the moral necessity to assist others went hand in hand. Marvin Olasky writes in The Tragedy of American Compassion that shortly after landing at Plymouth in 1620, the pilgrims were ravaged with disease. Only six or seven were able to move about, while the others languished in misery. But those few still on their feet accepted the task of caring for the others in need. As William Bradford notes in his writing at the time, those who were able, quote, "in ye time of most distress, spared no pains, night nor day, but with abundance of toil and hazard of their own health, fetched them wood, made them fires, dressed their meat, made their beds, washed their loathsome cloth, clothed and unclothed them, in a word, did all homely and necessary offices for them. This they did willingly and cheerfully, without grudging in the least. This was the pilgrim attitude toward helping their neighbors in need. The pilgrims were pledged to care for one another, and their neighbors joined forces to drain a swamp on one man's property, clear trees on that of another. If the parents of a child fell ill or died, it was understood that another family member would care for the children as for their own. The town council of Fairfield, Connecticut, noted in its minutes of April 16, 1673, that, quote, Syrian Squire and Sam Moorhouse agreed to take care of Roger Knapp's family in this time of their great weakness, unquote. And in Chelmsford, Massachusetts, minutes from a town meeting in November 1753 indicate that a note payment was made to Mr. W. Parker for taking care of one Joanna Corey, a poor child of John Corey, deceased, and to care for her until she was 18 years old, unquote. While people like this voluntarily assumed the responsibility, Olasky writes that they were often reimbursed from the coffers of their town council for the expenses in caring for the needy. However, they undertook this care willingly and of their own free will because they believed that it was a moral responsibility rooted in their relationship to God. Olasky writes that in the colonial period, the Congregationalist and Presbyterian sermons regularly noted that faith without works is dead, and that compassion was something that everyone should practice. Anglicans also argued that those blessed materially by God should have compassion on the poor by descending into the misery with them to help them bring them up and pull them up. When Methodism spread in the 18th century, American followers propagated John Wesley's advice to put yourself in the place of every poor man and deal with him as you would have God deal with you. Colonial Americans were urged to be charitable out of gratitude to God for the bounty that he had given them. Thomas Bacon of Maryland said in a sermon of 1750, "We are indeed, my brethren, by God's blessing, in possession of a very plenteous land. We ought to show our thankfulness to him by not only promoting worship, but by instructing the poor how to provide for themselves by honest industry." The early Americans were urged to give out of love, not out of obligation. Benjamin Coleman warned, "God values our hearts and spirits above all our silver or gold, our herds and flocks. If a man would give all the substance of his house instead of love, it would be condemned." It's an echo of the famous passage on love in 1 Corinthians 13. These are the key concepts of the American virtues of the economy and charity. We've been blessed with bounty, and we should express our gratitude to God by voluntarily giving to those in need. However, we should give wisely in a way that encourages the needy to become productive themselves. The colonials were wise in the way that they gave alms. Preachers, including Cotton Mather in 1698, warned that if a person drank to excess or refused to work, giving aid to them without addressing the root cause for their poverty could actually contribute to their ruin. Giving without knowing the reason for a person's need could harm them if their plight was the result of poor choices, as the modern would say, or sin, as the Puritans said. People assisted the needy by giving them time, cloth, coal, or food, but seldom money. They paid close attention to their capability to provide for themselves. Relatives were expected to care for the incapacitated members of their own family, a practice which was written into the early laws of the Northwest Territory. While the influence of the ideas of Adam Smith on the market economy have been widely noted, particularly in this society, there was another Scotsman writing at about the same time, shortly after the publication of The Wealth of Nations, who has had a significant influence on the way we practice charity. The Scottish theologian Thomas Chalmers served as the rector of St. John's Parish in Glasgow from 1819 to 23, and after that occupied the chair of philosophy at St. Andrew's College. Chalmers waged a fight in the British Isles against the policy of what they called outdoor relief. This was a kind of aid that was given without checking into the need of the recipient, and it was also given to people who still lived in their homes rather than having gone to a poorhouse. Chalmers protested that that kind of aid would create dependency in the people that it was given to, and it would encourage people to apply who didn't really need it. His objections were both wise and prophetic. Chalmers claimed that this kind of aid would hurt the people it intended to help because it removed the need for self-help and discipline. He claimed that we are biblically obligated to become personally involved with the poor and that we should help them overcome the factors that made them poor in the first place. But those whose own failings had dragged them down needed to indicate a willingness to work and to change their attitudes and behavior. If they did not, Chalmers advocated that those helping should be prepared to step back, wait to see if the attitudes had changed, renew the offer. Chalmers got permission to mobilize parishioners to do outreach in the parish of St. John, a 10,000-person district in one of the poorer regions of Glasgow. The state agreed to stay out, and Chalmers would meet the expenses of the truly needy through the people in his parish. He divided the parish into 25 districts and assigned a deacon to each who would then verify the need of the individuals. The results were actually a gratifying success. The cost of caring for the needy dropped significantly as the better off in the parish counseled the people who were in need on how to spend money, how to save, how to get their lives organized again. Over 4 years, the number of paupers in the parish dropped from 164 to 99, with 20 new cases. With the savings to the church, the parishioners endowed a school. Now, there are two components to this approach worth taking a look at: not giving aid without investigating the genuine need, and dividing up the territory into what Chalmers called manageable portions of civic territory. The person in need had to demonstrate a willingness to work and become self-sufficient, but the caregiver also had to be willing to enter into a relationship with the person that they were assisting, to suffer with them. That is the true meaning of the word compassion, to suffer with. The New York Association for Improving the Condition of the Poor adopted the Chalmers plan and put it into effect in New York, dividing up the territory into districts. Volunteers were there to encourage the participants to find jobs, save money, enter life insurance programs, and send their children to school. The volunteers discouraged the general public from giving money to beggars indiscriminately. They visited the homes of the recipients of aid, getting the facts on their real needs, but they did not distribute money. Instead, they helped the people out of their dependence by empowering them to learn to earn for themselves. This approach characterized compassion in America through the mid-19th century, with societies springing up all over American cities based on Chalmers' model. The 18th and 19th centuries in America were characterized by a rich flowering of private voluntary associations to care for people in need: orphanages, relief societies for widows with small children, benevolent societies for the senile, and hospitals sprang up throughout America as a manifestation of faith in action. Catholics in New York built the House of the Good Shepherd for the reformation of fallen women and girls, while Jewish settlers established a Hebrew Benevolence Society in Charleston in 1784. Presbyterians in Petersburg, Virginia, established a Dorcas Society in 1822 to help the poor. In Boston, the Fragment Society, founded in 1812, provided material for clothes. The Hebrew Relief Society in New York, founded in 1831, assisted destitute pregnant women. There are thousands of such examples. This approach to helping people in need not only helps the recipient, it changes the giver as well. Alexis de Tocqueville observed that American individualism is countered effectively by these acts of serving others. They shape the character and the moral habits in a way that promote the best interest of all. In Chapter 8 of Democracy in America, Tocqueville notes, "It is held as a truth that man serves himself in serving his fellow creatures, and that his private interest is to do good. In the United States, hardly anybody talks of the beauty of virtue, but they do maintain that virtue is useful and prove it every day. An enlightened regard for themselves constantly prompts them to assist each other. It disciplines a number of citizens in habits of regularity, temperance, moderation, foresight, self-command. And if it does not lead men straight to virtue by the will, it gradually draws them in that direction by their habits. This is the acquisition of civic virtue. At the time that Tocqueville observed America, a rich flowering of voluntary associations covered much of the landscape. The reason for forming them had become a part of the American character. Caring for one another voluntarily, Americans were fostering their own character development." I'm going to stop here for the moment and turn the podium over to Bert Folsom, who will take up the story with Tocqueville, continue into the mid-20th century, at which point I will take up the narrative again.